Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 26th, 2002. Today's session is entitled Church Year in the Home, and the presenter is Dan Erlander. It is tape number 2002-24.
I'm ready to start. And this is a discussion on liturgy in the home, and I'm Dan Erlander from Whidbey Island, and one of the five presenters in our living liturgy. So welcome. And I think there's still some seats back in the corner. And if one of our ushers, too, if this gets all filled, if you could pull in a few folding chairs. Well, welcome. And I understand there was going to be a choir practice, and there was going to be the Reformed people's session at this time, and they both aren't. So this is the only thing going on in town.
It's raining.
I'm not taking it personally, the girl here. Thanks. I'd like to, we're going to talk about liturgy in the home and also expand it a little of connecting the liturgy with children. And one thing I like to say at the beginning when I present this is that if you've already raised your children, it would not be a Lutheran thing of grace for me to give the impression that you should feel very guilty that you didn't do all of this. You are totally absolved. But now for everyone, if your children are raised or if you do not have children, this is the work of the whole Christian community. Both parents, whom Luther said had a higher vocation than the Pope, that parents are priests and bishops to their children, a high office. But then the Christian community surrounding you and with you, and that can include the grandparents and others, helping as mentors. And so these ideas tonight are for everyone. The second is that I'm going to be talking a lot about children and raising children, and Karen and I do not have children, and that's why I'm such an expert. Well, I hope you will be leaning on my every word. I'd like to begin with a story of New Year's Eve. Quite a few years ago now, but on New Year's Eve we sometimes go up to Acme, Washington, which is up by the Canadian border, where we have dear friends, and some other friends from Seattle go up on New Year's Eve, and nothing is going on there, so it's just a fun evening, and then New Year's Day. And one year on New Year's Day, the adults were all working a big jigsaw puzzle. And I don't like jigsaw puzzles. So is there anybody else here that just doesn't do that? And you are accepted. So I went into the living room where the children are going to be watching a video, and I decided I'd watch it with them. And so I had the children around me and one of them on my lap, the TV here. And the video that they had was A Little Princess. And it's based on a novel by, if I remember, is it Hodgkins?
Frances.
And she also wrote The Secret Garden. And this was produced in a movie years ago with Shirley Temple, I think, as A Little Princess. And this is a newer version that we saw. But the story of the film, which I'm sure some of you have seen, The story of the film is a little girl named Sarah, probably, 8, 9 years old. And in England, First World War time, her mother has died. She's an only child and being raised by her father. Her father is called off to be in the war. And so she is sent to New York, and they have money, so she's put in a very exclusive girls' school in New York City. And are there still a few?
There's
still a few guys here. And it's fine for people to walk behind me. So she goes to this exclusive girls' school in New York City, and there she has the finest room in the school. She has the finest clothes, and she also becomes the most popular girl in the school, partly because she grew up in India, and where her father was in the whole colonial government in India. And she tells stories about India, exotic stories, and the girls all crowd around her to hear her stories. And her favorite possession is a locket that has opens up and has a picture of her mother on one side, her father on the other side. So things are great for her until, and in the movie, in the film, there's a, it's kind of like a melodrama. There's the villain is Miss Mitchkins. It's fine when you see this film that kind of hiss when Miss Mitchkins one day Miss Mitchkins calls Sarah into her office and just very, very coldly tells her, number one, her father has been killed in battle. Number two, all the money has run out. Number three, she will not be thrown out on the street, but she will have to give up all of her possessions and her room and become a servant girl in the school. And part of being a servant girl, you're on a different class now than the rest of the girls, so you cannot talk to any of them. And then she takes everything, even the locket. Send Sarah up to the cold attic, the cold wooden floor, to live. And she's dressed now in rags. Her job now is to clean toilets, clean the floors, clean out the fireplaces, do everything that a slave would do. And she also does this and lives up there with Becky, who is about her age, is African American. And there, one day she becomes very, very discouraged. Very discouraged. And Becky talks to her and reminds her of a story she once told about her father. And that story about her father was telling Sarah, if anyone ever tries to take away your dignity, just say and remember that your father said, you are a princess. Remember, Sarah now is the Hebrew word for princess. So then she hears Becky say that and remembers that, and she stands there and says, I am a princess. And then there's some chalk up there, and she makes a circle on the floor. And then she lies down in that circle and just is relaxed, and like she is being held by this circle. Now, the rest of the story I won't tell you because it's a fun ending. Not telling you the end, I can tell you this. That the rest of the story is what happens when a slave girl who is a slave on the outside has the mind and the heart of a princess. Mm-hmm. And then that is quite dramatic with Miss Mitchkins.
She gets hers.
Now, when the film video was over, and you know the names were all showing, and the children hadn't left yet, I just looked at all of them and I said, "Great baptism film." And then their eyes kind of rolled and they left. But I just sat there, and then I looked out and saw them playing outside. And this just thought came to me, will they have a circle? Will they have a place when the world and society starts telling them they are worthless if they don't, they're of no account if they don't have this or don't have this thin of a body if they're girls, or if they're not tough enough as they are boys. When they are discredited, will they have a circle? And so then that's when I thought, baptism, the founts are all round, the pools are all round, and that is our circle. So when we are discredited and are regarded as worthless or not fitting in, we can go there and just say, splashing those waters over us or making the sign of the cross, "My name is Daniel, and I am a precious child of God, and no one will take that away from me." What I'd like to share is, especially in the home, but also would be in the church community, is how do we, we've talked a lot about formation, how do we practice formation with our children so they have this kind of confidence as children of God. And so that's my beginning. And we might refer back to that. Now, the second thing I'd like to just relate a story of, this was many years ago, and this was a congregation in Spokane in the Valley. And Dennis, are you here? There. He is now pastor of this church, and what I'm going to say leans a little on the negative side, and I want to report that everything has been straightened out.
Exorcism blessing.
There's seats over here, and just don't be bashful. Don't be bashful. But I was invited there. I was in Spokane for some speaking, and I was invited there. And on Wednesday night, they had confirmation. And then during confirmation, they had all the parents came and had their class. And I was asked to teach the parents' class. And it was during Advent, not far from Christmas. And I... So part of the class, I asked all the parents, how many of you do something Christian celebrating in your home during the Advent and Christmas season? And not one hand went up.
Wow.
Not one. And this was 15 years ago, and I think we've done more in those, but not one hand went up. And then I as gently as I could just ask, "Well, what do you do?" And they admitted that the only thing they did at home during this season is the secular things. Mm-hmm. You know, the secular moving up towards Christmas, the presents, the Santa Claus story, and the whatever else, you know, is the... And so we talked about that, and what I discovered there, and what I've discovered other places, that many, many parents don't have the confidence to do Christian things at home. And I've had parents tell me this, that, you know, "I've never been to seminary. You know, I don't know the right words to use, and I'm afraid I'll say the wrong things." You know, just kind of this, it's a shyness. About being shy about talking about our faith, and especially being a priest and a bishop like Luther called parents to be. And so then that that got me thinking, and then moving up and being up at Holden Village and also in the parishes I was part of and in campus ministry, this this concern kept growing in my mind. And with others, I would just like to share some of the things we encourage people to start. And then part of tonight is then to have you add add your ideas, especially if your parents, but anyone, or memories from your when your children were growing up, or anything. But I'd like to just share a few of the things of, you know, how can we respond to this? Oh, I have one other reason that this concern grew even deeper, and that is in reading the theology book by Walter Wink, New Testament scholar at Auburn Theological Seminary. The book is Engaging the Powers. And near the front of this book, he expresses his concern, and he puts it this way, that the most dominant religion in America, and our Canadian friends, you might share if this is true in Canada too, but Walter Wink said the most dominant religion in America is the, by the way, it doesn't have anything in the Yellow Pages, but he calls it Babylonian religion. And it's a recreation, he says, of ancient Babylonian religion. Now, I think I mentioned over there that ancient Babylonian religion was centered around the violent meeting of Marduk, the great good god, and Tiamat, the evil woman goddess, and how their earth is created by slaying Tiamat, flaying her, and that makes the earth. And then that has to be repeated every year in order to keep order, because the Tiamat spirit is always moving in and needs to be destroyed again. And where Walter Wink says that this fits, he says this story is the most, the children are catechized by this story more than any other story that they ever hear. And then you say, well, I don't remember anybody teaching Babylonian religion. But then Walter Wink explains, this is the story. An unreformable bad guy is in conflict with a indestructible good guy. I forgot if that's the adjectives he used, but you follow him a bit. And the good guy is hopelessly caught in the struggle, and it just seems like there's no hope for the good guy until the good guy lashes out, defeats the evil one, and kills the evil one, and then order is restored to the universe until the next episode.
High noon.
What?
High noon is an example.
Yeah, let's just throw out some examples.
Popeye.
Star Wars. Remember James Bond, how he's always hopelessly tied up just before the final. It's the same time
Batman,
that Popeye takes
Superman,
the spinach.
Spider-Man.
Yeah, Spider-Man. Yeah, and then not only the Power Rangers, but not only the films and the videos, but it's also the Nintendo games, the comic books. This story is just told over and over and over again. And Walter Wink calls it the myth of redemptive violence.
Wow.
The story that violence is what brings order back to the world. And if you didn't know this, sometimes adults still have this story and think that's the way to restore order in this world. And some are even elected to high office. Now, one thing, Walter, that was kind of smart. Walter Wink compares this to Sunday school, and he says that this religion has the most effective and intense catechetical program of any religion on earth, with the finest minds, the most talented artists, the most talented writers, and then the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours. And Walter Wink says we have no chance with our alternative story, which is the myth or the story of redemptive love. And we don't have a chance by just having 1 hour or 45 minutes on Sunday morning. However, that doesn't mean cancel, but it means it's going to be an intentional effort in our congregations of mentoring young people and telling the other story, but even more important, it needs to happen in the home. Needs to happen in the home. So that furthered my concern, and that this is a very important topic that we are with.
This Sunday is St. Michael and All Angels, and a couple of the texts are along those lines where Michael, with force and violence, defeats the forces of darkness and evil, the dragon, etc., etc. But that kind of fits into that pattern.
Yeah, and it's, Michael is in the context of Revelation.
Yeah.
Where the heart of Revelation is the wounded lamb, who is the only one who has power to break the seals and to finally reign as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, the suffering lamb. And so, Michael, in defeating the dragon, becomes a parable or a symbol that, is a mythological symbol. It would be similar to Jesus saying, "I did not come to bring peace, but the sword." Michael represents the defeat, but you're right, it's in violent terms, and therefore I don't think it's a children's story. But what do you think?
Probably not an adult story.
Yeah, we have all the... It isn't the only violent story in the Bible. David and Goliath. It's where we hold up Christ of the Lamb, as the highest story and the truest story and the story that judges all the other stories. And I know this is hard with children. I'll share some of the these are all kinds of little ways with the question. If you combine all of these little ways, do we have a chance? And I believe we do, because we have a story that is far more powerful, beautiful, and we have the Holy Spirit. So there isn't a lot of competition. But, in the long, the final sense. But here, one thing that came at this time is when Susan Martin and I were serving at PLU, and their Mary Emily was about 5 years old, Maggie was just born at that time. And part of working with Susan and Martin that Karen and I were invited into their home so often, got to be family, and I took notes over 8 years. And I'm just going to share some of the things I either saw or they told me about. Just little things that you don't have to go to seminary to learn. And have a liturgics class to learn the ritual. Every time their children took a bath, it was the sign of the cross on their forehead and a reminder of your baptism. And then when they got out of the bathtub, they chose to have large, expensive white towels. And they, all through the years, every time out of the bathtub, would put that towel around them. And as you put it around them, they just said, "You are wrapped in the love of Jesus." you're wrapped in the love of Jesus. When they had a fuss between the two girls, you know, called anger and misunderstanding and all that, then it was back to the bathtub. And then coming out of the bathtub and the towel, it would be this announcement that you are clean again all over. You know, when their children were sick, they would follow the book of James where it says, anoint the sick with oil. So they had this perfumed oil, and when a child was sick, they just put a little cross on the forehead, you know, and pray for the child's healing. And you notice in sensual ways, the children now are really being hugged by Jesus as they are growing up. And then baptism anniversary is a special plate that I think are in some gift stores that are red and say special day or something. I'm not advertising any specific gift shop, but they are. They say your special day or something.
Your special today. Bless you on your special day.
Bless you on your special day. And this was for birthdays and also baptism anniversaries. And at the baptism anniversary dinner, and this can be very, very simple, but it's just to eat out of that special plate, have the baptism candle burning, and if you burn one out, go back to church, they'll give you another one. Then to light that candle, and then to have a simple prayer for the one who is celebrating, including adults, the one whose anniversary of baptism it is. And then a laying on of hands. And we know from prayer around the cross how children love rituals. But you see them kneeling by these candles. You know, and that too, that can happen in the home. And then the church year, I think Susan mentioned that they would change the center table decoration after the part of the church calendar we are in. And this is very important because we are shaped by the way we keep time. I think I mentioned that. We are shaped the way we keep time. And we aren't Jehovah's Witnesses that don't do any of the cultural things. It's part of being fun in a society. But how can our children learn our real calendar is the church year. Did I tell about the little boy in the library that Karen asked what?
No.
Oh, okay. I always forget which living liturgy I'm at. it was right after Christmas Day, and she works in the public library, and this little boy came in, checked out a book, and she tries to say something, so she says, well, now Christmas is over. What are you looking forward to now? And he looked up to her and he said, Epiphany. You know, and she came home and said, where did he get that? There's hope. Table prayers change during the season of the church year. For example, Advent always was Maranatha, come Lord Jesus, be our guest, donate these gifts to us, be blessed. So and then just simple changes in the table prayer. Then only Susan would do this, to wrap around the whole inside of the house sometimes, and that was to make a calendar with all 360 days. We only have about an eighth of it out here. Here's the rest. And if you afterwards come up and look at the pictures, but this is a way that children can say, oh, this is where we are. And they've included special days that they... special days as a family that they remember in prayer. Here's the third Sunday in Advent. Candles are on here. December 5, a picture of St. Nicholas. And am I right that children would just be very intrigued about following this through the years? So I want to share a few other ideas, and then I want to talk about the experience of signing children with the sign of the cross. And then, how long do we go till? Is it till 7:15? Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to share now a few. This is just something to come and look at afterwards. And maybe Living Liturgy should print this up. You know, I don't know how you would run this off on a.
Does she do this every year?
No, I think it's adaptable to any year. I suppose the movable.
She has the Sundays and yeah. Those would change to Christmas.
Yeah. She doesn't have a number.
There's no date.
There's no date.
Yeah, she's got it on a. It's Friday that week because it's space and Sunday.
Yeah, you'll have to ask Susan.
I don't know
how
she
put it. How she adjusted the movable. Movable piece. I suppose you could with the scissors and scotch tape. Right. Yeah. Now, I'd like to share this one idea years ago, and other people were thinking of the same idea, is why not every day as children are growing up make the sign of the cross at some special time on their forehead and just say these simple. And all I did was write on here the entire theological education that is needed to do what I'm suggesting. And then the third one is remember your baptism. You are a precious child of God. Or this is your circle. Coming back to the circle. And when I say we, I say some of us at Holden or outside with other pastors and others, we would talk about this. And it's long enough now that the stories have started coming back. And so I'll just tell a few of those stories. One was a mother of four girls in Minnesota, and every day when they walked out of the door to go to the school bus, they would have to pass her to be signed. And told they were a precious child of God by their baptism. And I saw the mother recently, and she said one morning she saw the bus stop, and their youngest daughter jumped off and came running back to the house. And she met him. She met her like, "Oh, what's wrong?" And he said, "You forgot something." And she'd forgotten that day. To sign them. And so, what did you tell the bus driver? And said that I forgot something that is very, very, very important. When their oldest daughter was married and was having her first child, when she was being rolled down the hospital hallway, and she said, "Mother, I want you to cross me before I go." And then I just thought, now it's be started by a mother in the next generation. There's bittersweet stories. One mother told me that she had done this for years as her child who was bipolar was growing up. And in high school, the girl called her one day and said she was committing suicide. And this was the last call. She was saying goodbye, and she was going to hang up now and not tell her mother where she was. And her mother tried to talk to her, but it wasn't working. And she just finally, just very strongly, said, "Put your finger on your forehead." And then there was this silence. She said there was a silence on the phone. And then the next word she heard on the phone was, "Mom, I'm coming home." You know, and this doesn't mean it's always going to save lives, you know, but there's power in symbol. There's power in a symbol that is entered deeply, or a ritual that's entered deeply into a child. A family in our church went back to Illinois for an old-fashioned funeral of a grandfather in the wake the night before the open casket. And before they left, little Emily was three, and she asked her father if she could, if he'd lift her up so she could say goodbye to Grandpa. And he lifted her up, and she started reaching towards his head, and so he followed her. And she made the sign of the cross and just told her grandfather that he was the precious child of God. When we heard this, it was just weeping. Father told me that he adapted this, and every night when the children were growing up, he would kiss them once on the forehead, once on each cheek, and once on the chin. And people would say, well, they don't know what that means. He says, someday they'll ask. And he says, they did. Then he told them, the cross is the cross of Jesus, and you were baptized. And every night it was Jesus telling you that Jesus loves you. Another mother that did this, when her son was 13, he asked his mother to stop. He says, I'm too old for this. So for the next year, she signed his door. And then she said when he was 18, 17 or 18, one day he said, Mom, you can start again. These are just some of the... This was in Spokane again, an older couple that I'd been there teaching and then came back maybe 2 years later, and I saw it was just the woman, not the man. So I went up and asked, and she said that he died 2 months before. And he says, but I've been waiting. Something I want to tell you, that the last words he said before he died was, will you make the sign once more? And that she did as he was dying. I'll leave that. And then, I have one more that every time I go on one of these speaking things, Karen signs me and says, I'm a precious child of God and I'm baptized. And then she says, and be perky. Really try. Okay, just a few more ideas and then I want to open this up. You can ask more about this. Another is the idea of the baptism box. And if you... Somebody in the church builds a wooden box with a lid. You burn or some way put the child and baptism date on the box. And then this becomes my church box for my years of growing up. And then there's even a couple down in Texas that have a business shipping out baptism boxes, and they have a whole process of how to use your baptism box. Then that's where the baptism candle goes. That's where their certificate goes. If there's a little towel, that's where it goes. And then godparents are encouraged to send things for the box over the years, the little Bible story book, until this becomes that precious box of memories and a reminder that I am baptized. And another is a family worship center, and this Susan alluded to this with the center place. We have a woman on the island who is a Roman Catholic who teaches on this, and she encourages families to have a little shelf someplace that's kind of the family altar, with some votive candles, and then you change that at the church here or on the baptism day. That's where the candle goes, or you have pictures for the different church calendars. And her husband is not an intentional Christian or a church person, so they include things that are special to him. He's an ecologist, and they have flowers, they have wheat at times. But this becomes a very special family area where the church calendar is kept. Then, on top of that, so many, many homes have nothing on any of the walls are Christian pictures. Do you know what I mean? You know, pictures of Jesus or icons or a cross. So when people come to visit, you know, or the little fish on the door, you know, this is reminds us where our first loyalty is. And I got a little carried away with this. Our living room looks like a inside of a monastery. I had a boyfriend of my niece who'd never been to church, never raised, you know, and he walked in and saw all of these crucifixes and icons all over. He said, you know, I'm getting to love Western spirituality. When you have it all over your walls, I really love it here. I mentioned some things about Advent, you know, about the Christmas tree, and this can be done at home also. And always to make the church calendar things as fun as they can be, so you aren't a crabby liturgist family. We don't do it the way other people do it. Someday you'll understand. Just the fun of carrying the wise men closer to your empty crash at home, too. And also, you know, in the same with the other special, like Easter and Pentecost, how can they be made fun at home? I'm going to stop there so you can share ideas, or if you have a question about something I've brought up, and how do you do it, or what, or others, especially parents here that have tried things.
Yeah.
I hear a voice.
I'm one of six children in my family, and we always grew up celebrating our baptismal birthdays. But one of the most special times, our baptismal candles came out, where when each of us got married, my mother put our baptismal candle on the altar.
I'm taking notes.
I can just say that with our three kids close together, that the best part of the baptism anniversary, the part they really had the most fun with as well as the most meaningful, was the laying on hands and blessing each other, you know, choosing a blessing. And, you know, sometimes it might have a little edge to it, you know, like, give him patience. But it always was very meaningful.
Children love that, don't they, to have hands placed on them and a prayer just for me.
At Christmas and on our kids' baptism, we do the birthday cake.
Oh, you do birthday. What do you do in birthday, Sam?
Birthday cake. We have the symbols of baptism around it. One was baptized, and the other one baptism of our Lord.
Beautiful. And then they learn that this is a birth that's as special as my human birthday.
One of the things that we did with our confirmation class when they were confirmed, after we pastors put our hands on each confirmand, we would have them, they were kneeling when we did that, and we would have them stand up, and their parents would give a blessing to them, just following the... as I said, after what the pastors did. But I would send out I would have a night when I would talk to the parents about some people just are a little scared about it, doing it in front of the congregation, but I gave them a chapter out of Henry Nouwen's book, Life of the Beloved. There's a chapter in there about being blessed. And so I sent that to them in the mail. I guess I shouldn't be saying that today. But anyway. Anyway, it was one of the most meaningful things. I mean, the congregation said they were so touched by seeing the parents bless the children.
And it also reminds me of Linda's book, you know, these special times. And I had One of them I noticed in your book that I think I mentioned Ronald Grimes, who's probably a leading ritual expert, or writes the textbooks for college ritual anthropology classes. And I heard him lecture once to Christians, and he said that one of the real problems he has with Christians is that there's no ritual, really no ritual, to surround the birth of a child. And I noticed you had that. That's the first thing I looked for.
Yeah. Several, actually. Birth of a child, adoption of a child, naming of a child. Mm-hmm. We don't pay much attention. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Our congregation produced, we have a baptismal banner over the baptismal font, which is placed at the entrance of the church where the church is around on both sides. All the children go up for baptisms. And then at the Baptism of the Lord Sunday, what they do is they give baptismal banners to children who are baptized other than at the church. Mm-hmm. So they also have a baptismal banner. So when you walk in our house, you come down a small entry hall, there's the three baptismal banners for all three children. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All of these are identity creating, aren't they? Yeah.
Well, for the beginning of Sunday school this year, for the children's sermon, I had all of the kids come up, all of the Sunday school kids, even the teenagers who didn't want to come up and be uncool, but around the font, and then I had their parents or whoever come up and lay hands on them and did a blessing for the children. And then I told all the adults to sit down except for the Sunday school teachers. And I had the Sunday school teachers stand in front of the font, and I had the children bless the Sunday school teachers.
Well, I love that. I bet they were serious.
Yeah.
About it. We, in Quincy Island, we built a new church building, and Rich Cammer designed the furniture. And we had a real argument with him because he wanted the baptismal font with the biggest bowl a craftsperson, potter, could make. And then he wanted it about this high. You know, and we just thought, that's going to look funny. You know, baptism fonts are this high. You know, so we argued, and we finally compromised at 1 inch higher than he wanted it. You know, one of the arguments, well, kids are going to just splash around in there, and they're not going to respect this. And have never had an incident. Only one, a junior high school kid, dropped a plastic fly in at once. Children are so respectful of that place, and it's on. You go past this when you go up for communion, and the family stop at the font and they sign each other with the water. And in fact, most of the children do, and probably half of the adults take water up and make the sign. And the children can reach it. And sometimes I'll look inside the sanctuary, and a family will be in there, and they're signing each other at the font. And so, okay.
Dan, one of the things that my in-laws have done for each of their grandchildren is they've had a wooden plaque made. Mm-hmm. It's about yay big. It has an oval mirror in it. And underneath it has their name, Jessica Lynn. You are a child of God, sealed by the Holy Spirit and marked for the cross of Christ forever. Mm-hmm. And then the baptism date. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that you hang it at their level, and as they grow, you move it up. So each morning when they get up, they see themselves.
Oh,
yes.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And that's what they read.
You know, when I was growing up, nobody said anything about baptism anniversaries. This is a hopeful.
I'm curious for other ways in which grandparents and godparents can be actively involved in the lives of kids from a distance, especially there are so many that are not at all local that want to be involved. So I'm curious to hear any.
Any ideas for
I can't remember who does these, but I think it's Creative Communications has a series of cards for baptismal anniversary that start with birth and go through, I think, about age 12 or 13. And I use those for my God kids, partially because they remind me, you know, each year to do something. And I just mark the baptismal box. That's what my God says I'm getting this year.
Oh. That's great. But almost every congregation has a retired, usually a man, that has a carpenter shop and loves to Yeah. It's a way of this person, it's almost like the office of a Christian education carpenter.
But I've also done things like given, probably the one that I was the most anxious about is you can buy the little fountains that you put together. Mm-hmm. And I got that for my godson when he was like 4, when I made a trip back to Ohio and had time to spend with him putting it together. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure how this was going to work, but he was so excited about it. And we got it put together and we took it into the kitchen and filled it with water. And it was on the counter, and he was sitting on the counter when we plugged it in, and it started bubbling. Mm-hmm. Wow. And we explained, you know, about the sign of the cross and everything, and I reached in, and I made the sign of the cross on him. And then it's just like you said, they get it. And so he reaches in, and he takes the water, and he makes the sign of the cross on me, and then he turns to his brother and sister and his parents, and then it turned into a lot of fun, and we got goofy, but... You know, for that portion. And I'm a quilter, so I sometimes do things like a growth chart in quilting that kind of marks, kind of from a Christian perspective, what growth is.
Like. Certainly prayer. Did you ever hear Terry Fredheim mention, this is, you know, even though we weren't celebrating baptism as well when we were babies, that when he was ordained, his godmother was his aunt, gave him a card and her blessings and everything upon his ordination. And she said, I have been praying for you every day of your life since your baptism.
Think of what that would mean to a child growing
every
up.
Day.
Every day. And, one thing not to forget, this is so obvious, but the is just storytelling, and to tell the stories of the faith, the appropriate story. I wouldn't tell the one like about Tamer. that's for later, right? But stories, and once again, we're doing this. The primary reason is our deep concern that we nourish that which has been planted in baptism. No, and then my other concern is kind of this rebellious, we need to counter the other story, the story of redemptive love. Yeah, here's one.
My mother is Puerto Rican, and I'm going to speak about Christmas and the secular world. In Puerto Rico, they don't celebrate a Santa Claus. When they have a Christmas party, it's the three wise men that show up, and every child looks forward to Epiphany, and they put a box at the end of their bed with straw in it, and they pick the wise men that they want to bring them their gift, and that wise man's camel eats the straw, and the wise man leaves the gift in thanks. And so as my mother shared this story with my children, we had a chance then to move to Puerto Rico for 3 years and got to live it where they were going to parties, where the three wise men showed up, and all of a sudden this was all real to them. And that has remained for them, now with their children.
Have you seen any chalk numbers here at Holden Open Doors?
Yeah.
You know what that... They're the initials of the three wise men, and it's similar to that. It's so the wise men will know where to come, and then it has a date of Epiphany, and these are given out at the Epiphany service or Eucharist here, and then a piece of chalk is given to each person to go back to put it over their doors. And it's we've done it and had people or delivery people say, what's that? You know, and then she can say, well, of course, it's Balthazar and Melchior and whatever. They come here on the 6th of January and just guides them in.
I think we can use times of crisis
as a way to tell a story. And my example was our grandson at 13 months had major heart surgery. And of course, we were very concerned about Nicholas. But I've written the story about him in the hospital and how we prayed and that his dad carried him. Mm-hmm. And to let him know that... that he was so important to us that we were all there supporting him. And then another instance was I was visiting my 1 week grandchild and he stopped breathing in the night. And we got him breathing. And I've written the story of that event that we worked so hard and we were so glad when we heard him cry because he'd come back to life for us and for and that God was with him. And I think it can be kind of some momentous things, too, that we can try to interpret for them that they were really important to us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It brought another thought, but that, think of when they would read that later, how precious. And also, everyone doesn't have the talent for it, but maybe everybody. But to make up your own stories and tell to the children. And I had another one. But, you were
asking. Could you comment just briefly on Lenten celebrations, especially with younger children and marking the forfeits and with the ashes and the death and how they live that one out?
Yeah. Children. Again, there were a lot of things like going up and having ashes.
And burn the leaves beforehand.
Yeah, and then the children get into the process of the palm branches and that are burned. And then this is. And what I've not experienced with children is how would you explain Ash Wednesday? You say this is a reminder that we are going to die someday.
We this comes up at preschool for our K through 8, and we do Ash Wednesday and observe it. And so far, I said this is a reminder of our baptism, also that we do not live forever.
Yeah, that's a beautiful.
That's how I put it. But just beyond that, home celebrations at Lent. I'd be curious to see if you or anybody has done things.
Lent, one way to say Lent is this time when we intensify the spiritual practices that are normal. One of them during Lent would be for families to intentionally think about social service or calling on shut-ins. We had one family in our church that were brave people, but they would take their children down to downtown Seattle in the evening, and they'd spend weeks decorating gloves and things to just walk around handing to homeless people. They'd also bring box lunches, this would be the teaching that this is a special time, and you might do this all year, or other ways, children might love to help at a food bank. Some have some other ideas. Carla?
I find that both my own children, who are now almost 13 and almost 14, that there was a tremendous amount of resources for ideas for small children. Mm-hmm. But when they get to adolescence, it's another really critical time. And I found, actually, for those of you with adolescent daughters, a wonderful resource done by some women at the United Methodist Church in Whidbey. Mm-hmm. With the island in Washington. I'm forgetting the name of it, but it's a wonderful resource where the adult women, take the adolescent women away for a weekend and really celebrate their womanhood and through a variety of ritual and prayer and laying on hands to do these wonderful things. And I'm looking for a similar resource for boys. So everybody look at me, if you got the ideas, catch me later. I had so much stuff I could do with and for them as little children. But now, as young boys, I'm not aware of any resources. So, any of the resources for kind of coming of age for boys and girls.
If I could just say a little more about that, it's on South Whidbey, and three mothers would have a retreat every year and invite junior high girls and their mothers, and they develop this very, very wonderful affirming the dignity of womanhood as you move into womanhood. A whole weekend retreat at one of the houses of one of the women that has got a beautiful park view and all that. And they have published this all now. It's just been published by Pilgrim Press.
Do you remember the name that they have? I'm not remembering the name of it.
Well, I might remember it by tomorrow.
Okay.
But it's Pilgrim Press, and and one of the authors is Gloria Koll, K-O-L-L, and the other author is Sally Windecker. I'm sure that's how you could get to it, by Pilgrim Press website. But the book is beautifully laid out on how to do this. And it is right. It fills in for adolescent, rituals.
Are you aware of anything or anyone else?
For boys. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, the only one I've ever heard is a long time ago. There's a pastor that really gained the trust of the families and would take the boys, on a retreat, and had a lot of very wonderful Christian ritual manhood ceremonies.
I think it's a real hole.
Yeah.
I think James Dobson has a set of tapes for a dad and a teenage boy, adolescent boy, to listen to together and talk about the gene that takes place there.
Yeah.
Oh.
Cool.
Sandra's not here right now, but my kids are young, 2, 5, and 8. But one of the things for Lent, I let them take kids to knives and carve parts of soap. And then throughout the days of Lent, when they wash their hands, kind of the daily ritual of cleansing and of discipline. And then they like washing their hands a lot. And then the other thing I just wanted to encourage is that children love to actually go to church in your home. And I homeschool my kids, so it's easier. But every morning, we start at our little buffet that has a candle and then the little kids' Bible. And all we do is go, and, of course, the highlight is who gets to light the candle and who gets to snuff the candle. But we light the candle, and then we just sing some little finger play song, Come, Lord Jesus. And then we read a Bible story, and then we open it up for little prayers, and then we snuff the candle. And they love it.
Another Lenten, I'm thinking. Well, again, it just proves children love ritual. And the ritual, if it's Christian ritual, is working on their hearts. I really believe that. Another way I thought of during Lent is simplifying during Lent, and also having special times at home. Maybe like the potato day here at Holden. We all survived, I think. And then have them see the amount that's growing over Lent for World Hunger Appeal or some other
things from that. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Natalie Sleeth's song, In the Bowl There Is a Flower. I've done this with kids at church, but it can happen at home too, where you plant bowls at the beginning of Lent. Specifically, I've always used amaryllis bulbs because of the time it takes for them to, and then they're usually in bloom on Easter Sunday. You can bake pretzels with the kids because there's a connection with the shape of the pretzel and the penitential attitude.
Also, the way you put your arms for prayer during Lent.
Yes, 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 that mirrors that, yeah.
The pretzel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's the hymn of promise.
Boy, there's hundreds. We could make a booklet.
I gave this out to parents of small children. There's resurrection cookies or empty tomb cookies that you can bake, and you do it the night before on Easter, and you heat the oven, and you turn the oven on, and you put the cookies in, and you leave them. Hmm. And the next morning, they're like empty on the inside, and you're like an empty tomb.
The other is eggs at Easter time, which is basically kind of a fertility. The Orthodox Church has a great tradition of Easter eggs. and you knock your Easter egg on somebody else's and say, Christ is risen, he is risen indeed. And then you decorate it with Christian symbols. You know, this is just one of the whole well, it is, oh, we're 5 minutes over. So, blessings to all the
until you do it.
That is so special. Yeah, just again, it just proves that